come in and read the Word of God. Now look, if you are on your way to heaven, and I am on the way to hell, what is this to you?
Can't do it. We'll do it live. No. We'll do it live. It. Do it live. I'll write it and we'll do it live. And thing sucks.
And WBAI, you're on the air. Good morning.
Morning. I think you guys are doing a terrific job. There's some wonderful people overnight. I think Max Schmid is brilliant and Arpo Martin is brilliant, but I don't know how many people get to hear them. And I want to say thanks. Tremendous job.
Well, thank you very much for that.
Schmid. All right, time for Gene Shepherd, real quick, from the Gary Hines collection. And we had two from this very day in history that have never been played before. We have selected from October 2nd, 1962, The Romantic Engineer, including such stories as Cornerstone Beatniks and Bagged Drunken Engineer. And if we don't start it right now, I won't have time to play my outro into the next program. WBAI New York. And yes, all of these Gary Hines programs from this vintage, whoever recorded them did not record the intros. They started after the theme, so Gary stuck the same intro onto every program. And that's what you're hearing now. Enjoy. Gene Shepherd here on the Best Bit of History, WBAI New York. Have I talked over it enough?
We'll be right back. don't know whether or not I should tell that terrible radio story. A lot of people write to me and they say, is it happening on radio? Well, actually, the terrible radio story can be heard any time you just turn your radio on and tune to any part of the dial. You'll hear the terrible radio story coming out at you usually 24 hours a day. with 8-second newscasts sandwiched in between. You know that records today on many radio stations, that they don't even end them. Are you aware of that? That the new records don't have an end. Because, you see, they want to be able to go right into a commercial without having any problem of juxtaposition. No, I'm serious about it, that most records... Do you know that about, maybe 10, 12, 15 years ago, when you made a single record, it was about 3 minutes long. Today, a single record is often less than 2 minutes long, just about a minute and a half long. The reason being, one, if they're shorter, a guy can get more nickels per hour in a jukebox. You realize that? He can get two, what are they, a dime now to play one of those abominations? A dime now, huh? Well, he can get, you see, for what he used to get just for one play, now he can get two. If they're a minute and a half, they go like that. You see, you can just knock down more dimes per minute, more torture per hour, and more income per day. And, of course, the radio stations are the same way, that if the records are too long, people get mad if you cut them in the middle of the second lyric. And you put on the dog food commercial, you know, the one that comes on. It tastes like people food, man. Well, you've got to do something about that. So the record people and the commercial people have gotten together now. And in many cases, the commercials are even longer than the records, which you have suspected all along, but up to this point was just an illusion, but is now actually true. And have you ever noticed that most of the records sort of fade away? At the end, they go, oh, Marshall, we don't want you, Yes, friend, and the number 7, and the number 5, and now, folks, it is a time, people food, and on and on it goes. Of course, one of the great fears that we have today, there's no question about it, is the fear of silence. Because often when a man is in total silence, he can hear himself ticking. And, most people today don't like to believe that they're made of flesh and blood and they tick. And like everything else made of flesh and blood, we go the way of flesh and blood. And it's a terrible thing to contemplate your navel in this day and age. And so there are all kinds of devices that, you think the radio is just for making the sounds? Do you think that the television is just for making sounds? Do you know that you can buy, now on the market, you can buy a device that you hook to your car radio where you can hear the soundtrack of TV shows. If you're missing Route 66 or something and you don't want to miss it, so you go out on the Jersey Turnpike and you have this little thing and you can hear this guy's... Mr. Clean. Well, you don't miss a thing then. And then everyone knows that you don't want to miss anything, do you? You've got to admit that one of the terrible things that you are missing about Jack Parr is that you're missing all that crying that he's doing between Monday and Friday. Now, you catch a little crying on Sunday now, I guess. He's on Sunday crying, isn't he? I understand that he cried on his first show. Came through in time. You can tell the old pros. They always come through. Virginia O'Brien never missed a sob. Virginia O'Brien. Oh, no, it was Margaret O'Brien was the sobber. Yeah, Margaret O'Brien, that's the one thing they called her. I remember stories about cameramen standing back then and saying, my golly, great Scott, there's an old pro, and you could hear her sobbing all the way, three sets over. And then they just turn it off, and they'd hold her off there while they're having lunch, and they'd start the scene. She starts sobbing all over again. And apparently there's something about a television camera that makes Parr sob right there. It just it sort of happens. I suppose he has a little TV camera in his bedroom there. But that's another story. Well, we're all here together. Friends, how are you? You want me to tell you a terrible radio story? Well... All right, I might as well tell you a terrible radio story since it's a Tuesday night and Tuesday nights are nothing anyway. Before we go into this radio story, there are so many things in the wind that must be reported, and I say that we're in a sense flubbing the dub when it comes to our moral duty to report the things that are really happening. Did you read the little note the other day? They dug up the time capsule, and it turns out that that time had played bad tricks on the time capsule, and they opened it up, and there was just nothing but old crummy stuff. It was all moldy, and nobody could read any of it. And it was a terrible jolt to most people who, yeah, did you read about that? It happened downtown. There was a building that had installed in it a time capsule. It was made like 50 years ago or something. And so it was supposed to be forever. And on the outside, it says, this is forever. It said, to those of the future generations who open it up, this will be forever. And you'll know how it was in these days. And they opened it up, and all the stuff had rotted away. So I guess that's how it was. And it scared everybody. They all stood around. They didn't know what to say. Because, you know, then all of a sudden you find your own sacred institutions rotting away in 500 years. When they open up the big time capsule where Billy Rose put it out there at Flushing Meadows, and all they can find is one yo-yo that survived the times, which incidentally would be probably true if it did survive. You know, speaking of the terrible fear that you're going to go, do you know that there used to be an old tradition in days past when they built a building, they had a thing called the cornerstone. Well, the cornerstone was philosophically the stone upon which the building was based. That's why they called it the cornerstone. And it would be like the roof tree, you know. It was very symbolic. And they said that on this stone here at the corner of 47th and Jackson, the giant four-story building is going to grow. And once again, it's a tribute to man's ingenuity and his desire for peace and to love everybody and to make dough. All right, so they put up this thing, and they put the cornerstone down. And now what they used to do in cornerstones was they put stuff in them. Many a cornerstone was hollow, you know. And they put, oh, yes, and in the cornerstone they would put a glove of the lady who, let's say, christened the building by breaking a bottle of Moxie over it or whatever it was, because that was during the days of the WCTU. And so they would put a glove in there, or they would put a baby shoe. Then they would put a picture of the president. Then there would be a picture of the mayor in there. There would be a picture of the architect. And then there would be a poem by Edgar Guest. And, yeah, all kinds of stuff. There would be a newspaper of the day, the day that the building was officially launched when they put the cornerstone down. I don't see anybody laying any cornerstones on these Meccano buildings all up and down Park Avenue. You know, these things that are designed by the Erector Set Company. It's funny. Do they have cornerstones? What do they put in them? A television rerun, an old Kinney or something for future generations to look at the Lucy Show? Of course, the Lucy Show will still be running, I'm sure, when the future generations show up. But I wonder, do they have a cornerstone on these buildings? I walked past a building on, let's see, was it 53rd? And I think around 3rd, just the other day. In fact, it was yesterday, and 53rd and 3rd, I believe it was, and it was on the east side of the street. Now, I'm trying to picture the scene again. And I'm walking along, and I see about four or five guys. It was lunchtime, and four or five guys are on the same side of the sidewalk as I am, and they're looking at the building. And they're trying to figure out from looking at the building where they are. Guy says, now, I know that building. And I looked up, and of course the building hadn't been there the day before, so it was sheer idiocy. They didn't know that building at all. What they were merely saying is that it looked like all the other buildings that they had seen, and it was the same building that had been built at 56th and 6th, you see, and the same building that was built at 40th and Park, and the same building that's built at 47th and Park, and the same building that's built at 53rd and Park, and the same one that they put up all over the same building, you see. And I don't know whether that's the same building or whether it's an illusion. Is it a roadshow? Seriously, has this outfit got a thing where they just go around and build the same building and they have a big ceremony and the mayor comes and they rent it all out and then they take it down and rent it out again somewhere else and evict? You see, everybody in this town is used to being evicted. So it doesn't bother a guy when he moved in, he's in there 4 minutes and they're evicting him already. He just accepts it now as the modern life, you know. The big new building is going down. Equitable Life is already tearing down the back of its building. And there's a new one going up there. It's a new assurance building. It's assurance building. It's a building that has a lot of solid things to it. Well, now, we are living in times, of course, where if you ever really stop, literally stop running, then you're suspect by everybody around you. You're a beatnik, usually, if you stop running. They call you a beatnik. You know, I'm continually called a beatnik. I don't know why I'm called a beatnik. Yeah, me, a beatnik. I don't know. Fascinating. Whenever a guy, of course, I'll tell you what the idea of calling people is this, roughly. that whatever is bugging people at that time, anything they don't like is that, roughly. So any guy today, whenever he really gets mad, he'll call a guy a communist, primarily because the guy, he doesn't like the guy. He doesn't like what he does. He doesn't like what he says. So he's a communist. Now, that particular guy is being bugged by communism. Now, there are a lot of people who are bugged by beatniks. They don't know why. They're just bugged. They never met a beatnik. Most of them never even saw one, you see, up there in Westchester. Well, there's a lot of beatniks in Westchester. The only thing is they're the real beatniks. They're the real beat. You can hear them quietly settling into the loam up there, even now, if you listen carefully, to the sound of olives being slurped up. Now, they're the true beat, really the true beat, as opposed to another kind of thing, which people continually confuse the beat and the hip. Very, very different people. The beat are the guys who really do put on those rotten television shows. That's another crew. But that, you know, you got here, there, and everywhere. Speaking of rotten shows, this is WOR AM and FM New York. And we might as well get right on to the business here. Speaking of shows, we have with us tonight, as we have had for the last couple of weeks, Show Magazine. And Show Magazine is, to my way of thinking, and in my very personal view, a very intelligent magazine, and one of the few magazines I've read in a long time about the world of arts that is not sappy. You know what I mean by sappy? You know, either a magazine tries awful hard to be cutting and incisive, thereby achieving a certain kind of silliness that goes beyond ordinary silliness, or else it's plain out-and-out fan mag stuff. You know, it's a very peculiar kind of fan mag stuff. Well, I think you will not only find this an interesting magazine, you'll find it a beautiful magazine, and you'll find it one of the most entertaining, irritating magazines that you can get every month. Primarily because the whole world of art today is very irritating. And it's a gas, really is. It's a 75-cent magazine, and they are giving you a subscription. And oh, by the way, this subscription price has been publicized in other places, but never on the radio at this price. And also, the subscription price has been changed since the other ads were put out. They are continuing it on the show. So for $5.75, you can get a one-year subscription to what is considered one of the best magazines today of the whole business of art. They cover the whole field, and if you would like to subscribe tonight, it is a great $5.75 worth. Give them a call at this number. They're on duty now, and they'll take your call, and you'll be in touch with their editorial offices. It's Plaza 2, 6161. They will bill you. Plaza 2, 6161. Okay, in New York, oh yes, reverse the charges. I'm sorry, I didn't tell you. So make them pay for it. Plaza 2, 6161. Now, all right, I'll tell you what I consider one of the wildest things that ever happened to me in radio. Now, I can only tell you this, that most of the things that happen in radio are not as simple as, well, as the ancient story about what the guy reputedly said when he thought the microphone was off. That's greasy kid stuff. I'm sorry. That's nothing. The real things that happen in radio are often so terrifying, they're often so wildly funny, that they never even reach the public. Now, I don't recall ever telling this story on the air, although I've been on the air a long time. I'll have to make another thing clear here. I don't often do this, but since the subject just came up tonight, the idea of telling a story about radio, I might as well tell you something. I'm continually getting letters from people who say, to whom do you direct your program? This is a very common question. I directed at no one, to be perfectly honest with you. I directed at me. I sit here and tell me stories that knock me out. That's the truth. I do not direct it at anyone, any more than a writer who is writing a novel directs his novel at an audience. He just doesn't do that. He's interested in telling a story, and he tells the story. Now, if somebody comes along and reads it, he's pleased. If they don't, well, that's the way the game goes. Back to the last. Back to the old grind mill, you know? Well, now, I don't direct any of my shows towards anybody. And furthermore, I'm continually getting letters from people who say, why don't you do that wonderful thing you did 1 year ago when you hurled an invective? Well, I want to tell you something about that. Maybe I shouldn't go into the philosophy behind... I don't think I will, so don't worry about it. I'll tell you this, though, that things that happen in radio sometimes are... I guess it's what makes it the very strange and and extremely attractive and almost diabolically insidious medium that it is. Radio is the most diabolical of all mediums, and I'll tell you why. Because it involves the imagination of the listener. Very few other mediums do. Television doesn't. It involves purely the imagination of the guy that's building the sets and the actor and the writer. But your imagination, you're totally passive. The viewer to a television show is passive. He's really not part of it. He just sits and gawks. Literally gawks. And if he doesn't like what he sees, okay, so he goes on to the next channel. But he is not involved. Now, music involves you. This is one of the reasons why many radio stations have gone into the musical world. They've because first of all, it's cheap, of course, there's no question about that. It's always a way to please people, because all people emotionally and are involved in some kind of music. They like it. It's a basic thing. And furthermore, people who listen to music, whether they like it or not, get involved in it, even if it's only on a subconscious level. But it's almost impossible to get involved in any kind of a television show. Literally involved. You may enjoy it. That's not what I mean. You may not like it, or you may get irritated with it, but you are not a participant in it. It's very different. However, radio, being the kind of medium it is possible to be a participant. Now, I'm not saying that it is often done anymore, because radio has become more or less a giant jukebox. However, the medium itself, do not blame paper as a medium. Do not blame the printing press for bad novels. Please. Do not blame the printing press for rotten tabloid newspapers. Because the same printing press, on the other hand, can reproduce a Faulkner novel. It can reproduce a magnificent poem. It's the medium. The medium is blameless. So don't blame radio for all the rotten stuff that's on it. I'm talking about the medium. You can blame a lot of the people who run the medium, yes. But please don't say the medium of radio. Radio as a medium is a secondary medium. It is a very volatile and highly dangerous medium. And I'm dangerous. I use that word very, very philosophically here. It is a medium that can achieve more genuine communication than any other 20th century medium I know. By genuine communication, I mean a contact between two minds. People have a hard time doing that on television because you keep watching the guy's Adam's apple bob up and down. When you watch Bertrand Russell, you're always thrown because his eyes water. And it's the truth. I'm telling you, it's the truth. So you find he comes through clearer in his writing than he does when he's sitting there talking, because he looks a little silly sometimes when his eyes watering there. Well, radio is a very pure medium, just like writing is a pure medium. It's very pure. Because the artist, the corporeal, the body of the artist is removed. And because the body of the artist is removed, you can then meet on a ground of understanding, a common understanding. Believe me, there's a lot of ramifications to this, but getting back to the subject of radio and wild things that happen in radio, I'll tell you a story, boy, that curled my hair one time. For the purposes, obviously, of protecting the guilty, I will give you no names, I will give you no radio station call letters where this occurred. Suffice it to say that it occurred in a very large city on the eastern seaboard, which we will not call New York, because it wasn't New York. I'm being honest with you, it was not New York. I was working in a radio station. And you know this? You don't know this story. Let me tell you the story. I was working in a radio station, and I had a very serious radio program. This very serious radio program had to do with classical music. At one point, I did a show which I got a terrific bang out of doing. It was a program of classical music that did not necessarily involve classical music. Let's put it on this basis, serious music, very different from classical music. That term is another one of those peculiar smoke screens that come up and keep, again, the understanding of things away from people. But I did a show of serious music that covered the whole spectrum of serious music, going all the way back to pre-Baroque music. Oh, yeah, and ranging all the way up into electronic music that the Germans are experimenting with and the Czechs are experimenting with. And it was a wild show. And in between the pieces of music, I would discuss the entire philosophical and artistic climate of the time out of which the music came by using other forms of communication, such as excerpts from novels of the same period, from poets of the same period, from humorists of the same period, to show that they were all saying the same thing. And even the writer himself, who wrote the music, was saying the same thing. A romantic writer, a period, let's say the romantic period of music, Brahms or Berlioz, they were saying the same thing that the novelists of the period were saying. They were saying it in their medium. They were saying the same thing that the poets of the period were saying, that the painters of the period were saying. Very interesting. That you cannot divorce yourself from your time. No matter what medium you use, if you're honestly producing in the medium. Now, a lot of guys are phoning it up and are not producing in the medium, but are merely reproducing in the medium. That's another thing. They reproduce other attitudes of past ages. They reproduce cliches. If you are really producing in a medium, I don't know how I got into this lecture here, you cannot escape your time if you are really an artist. Does. Now, on the other hand, now they say, well, now that's not true of radio. Well, I can tell you that there aren't many artists working in radio. So that does not necessarily mean that if they did work, it would come out that way. So this is the kind of show it was. It was a wild show, and I just had a terrific time doing it. Well, one night, let me tell you the story here. Ed, this is for you particularly to listen to. It was a wild moment. The kind of physical setup, I don't know whether you're familiar with the physical setup of radio stations, but they have many ways. Now, a lot of people think, for example, that whenever I play music behind me, which I use for mood or punctuation, I play the record. Get it out of your skull. I have nothing to do with it. Most big radio stations in the country have two or three individuals that work together to create a radio show technically. You've heard me refer to Ed often. Well, this is usually Ed Scatterday, who, or Ed Zajac once in a great while, and he's in the other room. He's through the glass there. Now, Ed does the mechanical things on the show. For example, he operates the controls and maintains a certain level, a dB level of my microphone. He also maintains the level of the record involved if I'm going to play a record. If I want to do any special effects, for example, if I want to drift off and I want to produce the sound of an echo, he makes sure that the gain is always right and proper so that it can be done. A lot of things you can do with microphones that the amateurs have not even touched yet, Ed. You know this. You see, Ed could tell the difference between the pros and the non-pros sitting in there. Then, on the other hand, he does all the technical work. My work over here is partly technical and mostly the other aspect of it, to call it roughly, the creative side of it, whatever that might be. Now, don't think for a minute that the technical side isn't creative either. It is. Because we have to work together almost as a single person. He knows where I'm going and I know what I'm doing and we go back and forth and it's a give and take. Well, this radio station that I worked in had roughly the same setup. In other words, the man who was in the control room, he operated the turntables and the microphone switches and so forth. Now, some radio stations have it set so that the announcer or the person who is working on the air, and by the way, most people never seem to make the differentiation between announcer and performer. Announcers and performers are two different people in radio. And quite often I will get a letter addressed to the announcer who is on duty at 11:15. I am not an announcer here. I do not work as an announcer at the station. That I am purely, tactically, simply, and contractually a performer. An announcer is a very different thing. An announcer is, for example, Ted Malley, whom you heard with the news earlier, is an announcer. Ted will come on after the show and be an announcer. That's a very different function in radio. That's very, very different. So, nevertheless, the setup was very interesting in this radio station. I don't know whether, see, I'm kind of hedging here. I don't know whether to tell you the story or not. It was such a shattering experience to me. Well, let me tell you this. Being an engineer, engineers develop. Now, they're technically called engineers, but technically they're not engineers. They're really operators. The men who work in the studio are operators who know studio techniques, they know microphone techniques, and they know recording techniques and so on. That is really essentially what they do. On the other hand, the engineer proper, to use the term in its technical sense, is the man out at the transmitter who is operating the transmitter itself. That's the transmitter by which the radio frequency emanations, the waves are broadcast that you hear. Now, he's way out in Carteret somewhere. Now, he is a licensed radio operator engineer. Now, the operators are another story. Now, they wind up very often very interesting men because they are around a creative atmosphere all of their lives. They're rarely in front of the public. And it bugs them. It's like stagehands are continually irritated. Stagehands, let me tell you, the first thing a stagehand does when Olivier comes off stage is he kicks him. He kicks him right where he usually sits, just for jot of general purpose. Get out of my way, will you, for crying out loud. Then he turns to his friend stagehand. These idiots are rushing away. And they move, and they throw Audrey Hepburn down a flight of stairs, and they sit back down to their pinochle game. Well, that's because they are very frustrated men, you know. It's much better to be out in the audience because you never have the very sneaky suspicion that you could get up and do it. But a stagehand, after 19 years standing behind the scenes, always feels that he can do it. He really does. He feels that, oh, what is this guy? Listen, I'm out there. To be or not to be. Oh, for crying. I can say that. Listen, I can say it. To be or not to be. How do you like that? To be or not to be. I can say just as well as he can. Yeah, fool. They sit back there, and they wind up with real big, fat union contracts that protect their right to do that. Now, it gets quite complicated. So one night, I'm sitting there doing my show, and now we've got it. Now, most engineers and performers sit, and they stare at each other. Ed will look me right in the eye, and I will look Ed right in the eye, you see. Now, I've known engineers who hated their job so much that the instant the show went on the air that they were working, they automatically, their ears cut off, they cut the monitor off, and they picked up their comic book or their Lafayette radio catalog. Immediately, absolutely immediately, they hated their job so much. And you know what I'm talking about. They, an hour after hour. Well, this sad engineer that I was working with was a frustrated artist. He had gotten into radio many years before and had not made it. He had started out as a creative person, and somewhere along the line he lost it. And he also, in addition to that, had all the juices of a creative person. Now that's a dangerous problem, as I'm sure that many of you have the juices of a creative man, but no talent. That really bugs people. I don't know of anything that bugs people more than that. It's a terrible thing. So, every night I used to do the show. As a matter of fact, the show was not a nightly show. It was much less than that, but it was a very big program and a very serious one, and one that had a lot of listeners. So every week I would sit at the little desk there and I would do the show. And of course it was obvious that I had a tremendous amount of enjoyment out of this thing. It was great joy to do it. It was something that was very important to me, and I loved doing it. And very few people in this life ever find anything they love to do. And they are often very teed off when they find somebody who does. That really bothers them. And particularly when people at one point had something they loved, or there was a glimmering over the horizon that there might be something they loved and they never found it. Or at least they have the illusion they never found it. And so every week I would sit there loving what I did, and the guy on the other side of the control room hated what he did. And we would sit, and the two of us would go. Well, over a period of time, there's only two ways it can go. Either you get so that you dig the guy a lot, you either get so that you dig each other a hell of a lot, or else you get so that you hate each other tremendously. It is just this way. This is the way man works. Now, I could get very philosophical and psychological, but it would be useless. We both know that this is true. You can argue, that's the way it goes. So every week I would come in and I would do my show. Well, I noticed something about him. He had problems. He was a drinker. Now, this is what often happens to romantic people. who never quite find that thing, that grail they're searching for. Most people, thank heavens, are not romantic. Most people are unimaginative. Most people are made of silly putty. And for that reason, they never have a glimmering of something beyond the edge of the Christmas tree. They never have a suspicion that there is something just beyond the next hill. They never quite have that suspicion. Most people will settle for the next Howard Johnson and are delighted to find it there. Well, there are that unholy few, those people who are bugged and will be bugged all of their lives. Now, they do many things to get out of it. Some of them take up jigsaw puzzles and plunge into that. Some of them frantically, just absolutely frantically, take up dry fly tying. Some of them get to be bittered, angry men who write letters to the Times signed anonymous, disgusted ex-reader. Others have one chick after the other, divorcing 47 women in the process. Then there are others that drink themselves into oblivion. They go out of their skull. Then, you know, they do many things, but you know them. We all know. We're all part of it. We're all alive. We all understand what it's like to be a human being. They're not weak people. They're disappointed people. They're romantic people. Well, I had this romantic engineer, and somewhere along the line, I got so I really liked him. But he hated my guts. I knew it. Oh, yeah, I knew it. And yet, he was too much of a romantic and too soft and warm to ever give in to it. You know what I mean? But he really didn't hate so much me. He hated the idea of me. The fact that I had found something that I loved completely to do. I'm sure he would have hated anybody else. It's like a guy who hates his wife because she has found something that she really digs. And he will yell and holler at her until she finally has to quit it. Because, you see, he's never found anything that he digs. And least of all, he doesn't dig her. And it must be a fantastic problem to live with somebody who's found something they dig. That must be impossible. Well, so every week we would come together this way. And so Ed is fascinated by this story. As we got to know each other better, he began to loosen up, and he began to allow his vices to take over. You see, at first he was afraid. Because, you see, I'll have to tell you something else that maybe you don't know about radio. That is, the man who's on the air is in charge. You know that, don't you? He is literally the captain of the ship. He is the one who the public is listening to. And he is the one who represents that radio station when he is on the air. So it is an unspoken law of radio that the man who is on the air is the captain. He is the boss at that time. He really is, you know. Well, a lot of engineers will argue that, but not deep down. They won't. They will not. So because it is well known that no engineer in history has ever gotten a decent Nielsen. It's just as simple as that. Also, there's another thing that goes into it, which we will not get into, but nevertheless, that's the truth. So when an engineer and a performer get together, when they're working on something that's really serious, I'm not just talking a little disc jockey show. This is much bigger than that. Remember that. They feel each other out often, especially if they're working together regularly. And the evolution of the relationship between performer and technician is always interesting. It's like the evolution between a cameraman working in a movie and the director who is directing the picture. Now, the cameraman is an important guy, too. I'm talking about the director of cinematography. I'm not talking about the little guy that brings in the batteries, you know. That's a very delicate relationship that exists because both of them have worked a long time to get where they are. They're both working on the same thing, and yet it is quite evident that one is really in charge. And so you have this very strange, ephemeral relationship that develops. So I'm doing this show. And as I got into it more and more, I enjoyed it more and more. I was beginning to feel my oats. It's like a guy who's an actor who suddenly, after acting for 10 years, suddenly discovers acting. You know, he really begins to act and really begins to love it. It's like a writer who has been writing around, fooling around with a typewriter for 100 years and earning his living, one day discovers what writing's about. And then he's out of his skull. He usually finds that out 5 minutes too late, just as he's about to cash in his check. Well, that's one of another sad type too, but nevertheless, I had just discovered what it was about. It was as though a whole new world had opened up before me. A world of really talking to people. A world of really, really making something go. There's a sense that I can't describe to you. It's like you discover the secret of something. Something that has eluded you, and in fact, you didn't even know there was a secret to it. That's even more subtle. You didn't know there was a secret. Most people go through their lives thinking they know everything about everything, and then they find out one day they didn't at all. The day their wife leaves with a bowling alley operator for Pitcairn, Pennsylvania. And they never understood it, you see. It's that they never knew anything about it in the first place. That's the secret of it. And the more you discover these doors, and the more you go through them, the wilder life gets, and the more exciting it gets. Until finally life gets so rich and so wonderful that it is impossible even to grow old. Just one day at a certain point you die. But you don't grow old when you have that feeling, because life is truly an eternal thing. It's out there, you see. Each guy has his chunk of it that he cuts off. And he either eats it or he doesn't. And if he eats it, it's there, you know. It's there, and it's there for all time. So I hope I'm not getting into metaphysics here. But nevertheless, this is all involved, you know, in this little story between me and the engineer. So one day, after having worked with him for about 2 years in this little, very isolated situation, two men working together in a state of suspended animation, very carefully watching each other's feelings, I began to notice that things were happening on the other side of the glass. For example, he would look at me with a look that was, well, I can only, I'll say that it was a look that had strange elements of pathos to it, and at the same time there was a slight edge of something more than that, a peculiar kind of humor, and that also was edged with a certain amount of sardonic cruelty. I'm just telling you what began to build up. Well, I also noticed another thing. He was beginning to hit the jug. I'd come in there, you know, and yeah, and every week it was like a progression. It was like a sawtooth wave. It did not even sag in the middle. That if you can measure hitting the jug, let's say, by a point system from 1 to 100, the first week it's 1, the next week it's 2, the next week it's 3, the next week it's 4. It does not go back to 1. The next week it's 5, the next week it's 6. Well, I didn't even discover till it was about up at 42. You see, so we're sitting there, and I began to notice this thing beginning to build up. Well, about the third or fourth month after I noticed this, of course, now it's getting wild. One night I'm doing the show, and get this one. I am doing the show, and he is sitting in the control room. He is sitting in the control room, and he has a large red-headed lady sitting on his lap. And this large red-headed lady was obviously a lady who was no better than she should be. And she was also a very raucous large red-headed lady. And it was quite obvious that they had a relationship prior to this point. I mean, they were old friends, probably old pinochle partners. So they're sitting, and I don't know, and I began to realize that what he's trying to do is he's trying to prove something to me about himself. I didn't realize that until the third stanza. Well, here is this large red-headed lady looking at me, and also the engineer, and they're both bagged. Well, that went along for a couple of weeks, and then one day she disappeared, you see. But he continued to spiral upward. And then it finally happened. The greatest thing that ever really happened to me in radio, as far as relationships between my fellow workers, it topped it all. In the beginning of the program this night, I sat down. We had it was a very complicated show. And by the way, it was a 3-hour show, a very, very highly listened to show. The beginning of the program opened up, and I looked in there, and he was looking at me intently. Now, up to this point, he had always busied himself with little things, like he'd dust off the top of the turntable, or he would whistle, or he'd wipe the glass a little bit, he'd wiggle the knobs, or always busy, but now he is sitting intently looking at me. And he reaches underneath his desk there, and he pulls out a bottle of bourbon, and he takes a big swig, first time he ever did it in front of me. Just looks. Well, I continue to go. Well, everything was fine for about the first 20 minutes, but you see, by this time, he had knocked down a half a fifth of bourbon. I never saw anything like it. Well, by the time the show was one-third over, he is leaning over sideways. Literally. And suddenly, he falls asleep. He falls right asleep, laying right there, and the microphone is open. And I cannot get him to put the record on. And he is asleep there. There is nobody else within miles around. The transmitter is 400 miles out in the country. The other engineer who was on duty was out to lunch or to supper or someplace else, and there we sat. And I am he is sleeping soundly, and his bottle is lying across one of the turntables and has dripped down on the floor. And I look up, and I'm continually talking. I'm talking about Berlioz now. Now I'm talking about, I look up like this, I get up, I'm looking down, and I'm talking about Zola. I'm talking about email, I read a little bit of Zola. Then I get down, and I go, there was no microphone switch. I couldn't, I bang on the glass. Nothing. I got up. It was wild. I'm talking like this, and I ran around, and I said, and now the song's off. I run around into the other control, into the control room, and he's lying there. I shake him. He doesn't move. I put the record on, and I can't cue it up because it's all, I don't know his controls. So I cue it back, and I get the thing. I finally somehow get it on, and I run back into there, and I realize the gain is wrong. I go in, and I adjust the gain. Well, to put the story into a nutshell, I finally wound up talking for over 70 minutes straight. And then finally the time came for the station to sign off the air, and he's still lying in there asleep, and I don't know what to do. I get up and I rush in. We're going to sign off the air. I rush in and I grab a hold of a transcription. I don't know. I'm looking for the Star Spangled Banner. I run back in again. And I can't do that. I run back in again. And I'm running back and forth, and the station is now on 10, 15 minutes late. The dials, the phones are buzzing from the transmitter until finally we just gradually faded out into the distance. He was not with me the next week.
Gene Shepherd from This Day in History, October 2nd, 1962. We're done. We'll be back next week with a very similar lineup. This is your curator and janitor, Max Schmid, bidding you a fond adieu, and stay tuned for Jimmy Dore here on WBAI New York.
Hi, George. Well, finished with the show. What do you want me to do now?
Did you have a good time in there?
Yeah. Oh, boy, it was fun.
Great. How'd you like to do it every day?
Yeah, yeah. That would be neat. Hey, wait a minute. Do I still get to be the janitor?
Sure.
Oh, okay. It's a deal.